The 15 Decisive Battles of the World, From Marathon to Waterloo, by Sir Edward Creasy, written in 1851. Read by Wesley Hurd. Chapter 1. The Battle of Marathon. 2,340 years ago, 490 BC, a council of Athenian officers was summoned on the slope of one of the mountains that look over the plain of Marathon, on the eastern coast of Attica. The immediate subject of their meeting was to consider whether they should give battle to an enemy that lay encamped on the shore beneath them. But on the result of their deliberations depended not merely the fate of two armies, but the whole future progress of human civilization. There were 11 members of that council of war. 10 were the generals, who were then annually elected at Athens, one for each of the local tribes into which the Athenians were divided. Each general led the men of his own tribe, and each was invested with equal military authority. One also, of the archons, was associated with them in the joint command of the collective force. This magistrate was termed the polemarch, or war ruler. He had the privilege of leading the right wing of the army in battle, and of taking part in all councils of war. A noble Athenian named Callimachus was the war ruler of this year, and as such stood listening to the earnest discussion of the 10 generals. They had indeed deep matter for anxiety, though little aware how momentous to mankind were the votes they were about to give, or how the generations to come would read with interest the record of their debate. They saw before them the invading forces of a mighty empire, which had in the last 50 years shattered and enslaved nearly all the kingdoms and principalities of the then known world. They knew that all the resources of their own country were comprised in the little army entrusted to their guidance. They saw before them a chosen host of the great king, sent to wreak his special wrath on that country, and on the other insolent little Greek community which had dared to aid his rebels and burn the capital of one of his provinces. That victorious host had already fulfilled half its mission of vengeance. Eretria, the confederate of Athens in the bold march against Sardis 9 years before, had fallen in the last few days, and the Athenian generals could discern from the heights of the island of Aegilia, in which the Persians had deposited their Eretrian prisoners whom they had reserved to be led away captives into Upper Asia, there to hear their doom from the lips of King Darius himself. Moreover, the men of Athens knew that in the camp before them was their own banished tyrant, Hippias, who was seeking to be reinstated by foreign scimitars in despotic sway over any remnant of his countrymen that might survive the sack of their town, and might be left behind as too worthless for leading away into Median bondage. The numerical disparity between the force which the Athenian commanders had under them and that which they were called on to encounter was fearfully apparent to some of the council. The historians who wrote nearest to the time of the battle do not pretend to give any detailed statements of the numbers engaged, but there are sufficient data for our making a general estimate. Every free Greek was trained to military duty, and from the incessant border wars between the different states, few Greeks reached the age of manhood without having seen some service. But the muster roll of free Athenian citizens of an age fit for military duty never exceeded 30,000. And at this epoch probably did not amount to 2/3 of that number. Moreover, the poorer portion of these were unprovided with the equipments and untrained to the operations of the regular infantry. Some detachments of the best armed troops would be required to garrison the city itself and man the various fortified posts in the territory, so that it is impossible to reckon the fully equipped force that marched from Athens to Marathon when the news of the Persian landing arrived at higher than 10,000 men. Footnote. The historians who lived long after the time of the battle, such as Justin, Plutarch, and others, give 10,000 as the number of the Athenian army. Not much reliance could be placed on their authority, if unsupported by other evidence. But a calculation made from the number of the Athenian free population remarkably confirms it. For the data of this, see Boeck's Public Economy of Athens, Volume 1, page 45. Some metoi koi probably served as hoplites at Marathon, but the number of resident aliens at Athens cannot have been large at this period. With one exception, the other Greeks held back from aiding them. Sparta had promised assistance, but the Persians had landed on the sixth day of the moon, and a religious scruple delayed the march of Spartan troops till the moon should have reached its full. From one quarter only, and that a most unexpected one, did Athens receive aid at the moment of her great peril. For some years before this time, the little state of Plataea, in Boeotia, being hard-pressed by her powerful neighbor, Thebes, had asked the protection of Athens, and had owed to an Athenian army the rescue of her independence. Now, when it was noised over Greece that the Mede had come from the uttermost parts of the earth to destroy Athens, the brave Plataeans, unsolicited, marched with their whole force to assist in the defense and to share the fortunes of their benefactors. The general levy of the Plataeans only amounted to 1,000 men, and this little column, marching from their city along the southern ridge of Mount Cithaeron, and thence across the Attic territory, joined the Athenian forces above Marathon almost immediately before the battle. The reinforcement was numerically small, but the gallant spirit of the men who composed it must have made it of tenfold value to the Athenians, and its presence must have gone far to dispel the cheerless feeling of being deserted and friendless, which the delay of the Spartan succors was calculated to create among the Athenian ranks. This generous daring of their weak but true-hearted ally was never forgotten at Athens. The Plataeans were made the fellow countrymen of the Athenians, except the right of exercising certain political functions. And from that time forth, in the solemn sacrifices at Athens, the public prayers were offered up for a joint blessing from heaven upon the Athenians and the Plataeans also. Footnote. Mr. Grote observes, in volume 4, page 464, that this volunteer march of the whole Plataean force to Marathon is one of the most affecting incidents of all Greek history. In truth, the whole career of Plataea, and the friendship, strong even unto death between her and Athens, form one of the most affecting episodes in the history of antiquity. In the Peloponnesian War, the Plataeans again were true to the Athenians against all risks and all calculation of self-interest, and the destruction of Plataea was the consequence. There are few nobler passages in the classics than the speech in which the Plataean prisoners of war, after the memorable siege of their city, justify before their Spartan executioners their loyal adherence to Athens. See Thucydides. After the junction of the column from Plataea, the Athenian commanders must have had under them about 11,000 fully armed and disciplined infantry, and probably a larger number of irregular, light-armed troops, as beside the poorer citizens who went to the field armed with javelins, cutlasses, and targets, each regular heavy-armed soldier was attended in the camp by one or more slaves, who were armed like the inferior freemen. Footnote. At the Battle of Plataea, 11 years after Marathon, each of the 8,000 Athenian regular infantry who served there was attended by a light-armed slave, Herodotus. Cavalry or archers the Athenians, on this occasion, had none, and the use in the field of military engines was not at that period introduced into ancient warfare. Contrasted with their own scanty forces, the Greek commanders saw stretched before them, along the shores of the winding bay, the tents and shipping of the varied nations that marched to do the bidding of the king of the eastern world. The difficulty of finding transports and of securing provisions would form the only limit to the numbers of the Persian army. Nor is there any reason to suppose the estimate of Justin exaggerated, who rates at 100,000 the force which on this occasion had sailed under the satraps Datis and Artaphernes from the Cilician shores against the devoted coasts of Euboea and Attica. And after largely deducting from this total, so as to allow for mere mariners and camp followers, there must still have remained fearful odds against the national levies of the Athenians. Nor could Greek generals then feel that confident in the superior quality of their troops which ever since the Battle of Marathon has animated Europeans in conflicts with the Asiatics, as, for instance, in the after-struggles between Greece and Persia, or when the Roman legions encountered the myriads of Mithridates and Tigranes, or as in the case in the Indian campaigns of our own regiments. On the contrary, up to the day of Marathon, the Medes and Persians were reputed invincible. They had more than once met Greek troops in Asia Minor, in Cyprus, in Egypt, and had invariably beaten them. Nothing can be stronger than the expressions used by the early Greek writers respecting the terror which the name of the Medes inspired, and the prostration of men's spirits before the apparently resistless career of the Persian arms. It is, therefore, little to be wondered at that 5 of the 10 Athenian generals shrank from the prospect of fighting a pitched battle against an enemy so superior in numbers and so formidable in military renown. Their own position on the heights was strong, and offered great advantages to a small defending force against assailing masses. They deemed it mere foolhardiness to descend into the plain to be trampled down by the Asiatic horse, overwhelmed with the archery, or cut to pieces by the invincible veterans of Cambyses and Cyrus. Moreover, Sparta, the great war state of Greece, had been applied to and had promised succor to Athens, though the religious observance which the Dorians paid to certain times and seasons had for the present delayed their march. Was it not wise, at any rate, to wait till the Spartans came up, and to have the help of the best troops in Greece before they exposed themselves to the shock of the dreaded Medes? Specious as these reasons might appear, the other 5 generals were for speedier and bolder operations, and fortunately for Athens and for the world, one of them was a man, not only of the highest military genius, but also of that energetic character which impresses its own type and ideas upon spirits feebler in conception. Miltiades was the head of one of the noblest houses of Athens. He ranked the Aesidae among his ancestry, and the blood of Achilles flowed in the veins of the hero of Marathon. One of his immediate ancestors had acquired the dominion of the Thracian Chersonese, and thus the family became at the same time Athenian citizens and Thracian princes. This occurred at the same time when Pisistratus was tyrant of Athens. 2 of the relatives of Miltiades, an uncle of the same name, and a brother named Stesagoras, had ruled the Caesarians before Miltiades became its prince. He had been brought up at Athens in the house of his father Cimon, who was renowned throughout Greece for his victories in the Olympic chariot races, and who must have been possessed of great wealth. The sons of Pisistratus, who succeeded their father in the tyranny at Athens, caused Cimon to be assassinated, but they treated the young Miltiades with favor and kindness, and when his brother Stesagoras died in the Chersonese, they sent him out there as lord of the principality. This was about 28 years before the Battle of Marathon, and it is with his arrival in the Chersonese that our first knowledge of the career and character of Miltiades commences. We find in the first act recorded of him proof of the same resolute and unscrupulous spirit that marked his mature age. His brother's authority in the principality had been shaken by war and revolt. Miltiades determined to rule more securely. On his arrival, he kept close within his house, as if he were mourning for his brother. The principal men of the Chersonese, hearing of this, assembled from all the towns and districts, and went together to the house of Miltiades on a visit of condolence. As soon as he had thus got them in his power, he made them all prisoners. He then asserted and maintained his own absolute authority in the peninsula, taking into his pay a body of 500 regular troops, and strengthening his interest by marrying the daughter of the king of the neighboring Thracians. When the Persian power was extended to the Hellespont and its neighborhood, Miltiades, as prince of the Chersonese, submitted to King Darius, and he was one of the numerous tributary rulers who led their contingents of men to serve in the Persian army in the expedition against Scythia. Miltiades and the vassal Greeks of Asia Minor were left by the Persian king in charge of the bridge across the Danube, when the invading army crossed that river and plunged into the wilds of the country that now is Russia, in vain pursuit of the ancestors of the modern Cossacks. On learning the reverses that Darius met with in the Scythian wilderness, Miltiades proposed to his companions that they should break the bridge down and leave the Persian king and his army to perish by famine and the Scythian arrows. The rulers of the Asiatic Greek cities, whom Miltiades addressed, shrank against this bold and ruthless stroke against the Persian power, and Darius returned in safety. But it was known what advice Miltiades had given, and the vengeance of Darius was thenceforth specially directed against the man who had counseled such a deadly blow against his empire and his person. The occupation of the Persian arms in other quarters left Miltiades for some years after this in possession of the Chersonese, but it was precarious and interrupted. He, however, availed himself of the opportunity which his position gave him of conciliating the goodwill of his fellow countrymen at Athens by conquering and placing under Athenian authority the islands of Lemnos and Imbros, to which Athens had ancient claims, but which she had never previously been able to bring into complete subjection. At length, in 494 BC, the complete suppression of the Ionian revolt by the Persians left their armies and fleets at liberty to act against the enemies of the great king to the west of the Hellespont. A strong squadron of Phoenician galleys was sent against the Chersonese. Miltiades knew that resistance was hopeless, and while the Phoenicians were at Tenedos, he loaded 5 galleys with all the treasure that he could collect and sailed away for Athens. The Phoenicians fell in with him and chased him hard along the north of the Aegean. One of his galleys, on board of which was his eldest son, Metiochus, was actually captured, but Miltiades, with the other 4, succeeded in reaching the friendly coast of Imbros in safety. Thence, he afterwards proceeded to Athens and resumed his station as a free citizen of the Athenian Commonwealth. The Athenians at this time had recently expelled Hippias, the son of Pisistratus, the last of their tyrants. They were in the full glow of their newly recovered liberty and equality, and the constitutional changes of Cleisthenes had inflamed their republican zeal to the utmost. Miltiades had enemies at Athens, and these, availing themselves of the state of popular feeling, brought him to trial for his life for having been tyrant of the Chersonese. The charge did not necessarily import any acts of cruelty or wrong to individuals. It was founded on no specific law, but it was based on the horror with which the Greeks of that age regarded every man who made himself compulsory master of his fellow men and exercised irresponsible dominion over them. The fact of Miltiades having so ruled in the Chersonese was undeniable, but the question which the Athenians, assembled in judgment, must have tried was whether Miltiades, by becoming tyrant of the Chersonese, deserved punishment as an Athenian citizen. The eminent service that he had done the state in conquering Lemnos and Imbros for it pleaded strongly in his favor. The people refused to convict him. He stood high in public opinion, and when the coming invasion of the Persians was known, the people wisely elected him one of their generals for the year. 2 other men of signal eminence in history, though their renown was achieved at a later period than that of Miltiades, were also among the 10 Athenian generals at Marathon. One was Themistocles, the future founder of the Athenian navy, and the destined victor of Salamis. The other was Aristides, who afterwards led the Athenian troops at Plataea, and whose integrity and just popularity acquired for his country, when the Persians had finally been repulsed, the advantageous preeminence of being acknowledged by half of the Greeks as their impartial leader and protector. It is not recorded what part either Themistocles or Aristides took in the debate of Council of War at Marathon, but from the character of Themistocles, his boldness, and his intuitive genius for extemporizing the best measures in every emergency, a quality which the greatest of historians ascribe to him beyond all his contemporaries, we may well believe that the vote of Themistocles was for prompt and decisive action. On the vote of Aristides it may be more difficult to speculate. His predilection for the Spartans may have made him wish to wait till they came up, but, though circumspect, he was neither timid as a soldier nor as a politician, and the bold advice of Miltiades may probably have found in Aristides a willing, most assuredly it found in him a candid hearer. Miltiades felt no hesitation as to the course which the Athenian army ought to pursue, and earnestly did he press his opinion on his brother generals. Practically acquainted with the organization of the Persian armies, Miltiades was convinced of the superiority of the Greek troops, if properly handled. He saw with the military eye of a great general the advantage which the position of the forces gave him for a sudden attack, and as a profound politician, he felt the perils of remaining inactive and giving treachery time to ruin the Athenian cause. One officer in the Council of War had not yet voted. This was Callimachus, the war ruler. The votes of the generals was 5-5, so that the voice of Callimachus would be decisive. On that vote, in all human probability, the destiny of all the nations of the world depended. Miltiades turned to him, and in simple soldierly eloquence, the substance of which we may read faithfully reported in Herodotus, who had conversed with the veterans of Marathon, the great Athenian thus adjured his countrymen to vote for giving battle. It now rests with you, Callimachus, either to enslave Athens, or by assuring her freedom, to win yourself an immortality of fame such as not even Harmodius and Aristogiton have acquired. For never, since the Athenians were a people, were they in such danger as they are in at this moment. If they bow the knee to these Medes, they are to be given up to Hippias, and you know what they will then have to suffer. But if Athens comes victorious out of this contest, she has it in her to become the first city of Greece. Your vote is to decide whether we are to join battle or not. If we do not bring on a battle presently, some factious intrigue will disunite the Athenians, and the city will be betrayed to the Medes. But if we fight before there is anything rotten in the state of Athens, I believe that, provided the gods will give fair play and no favor, we are able to get the best of it in the engagement. The vote of the brave war leader was gained. The council determined to give battle, and such was the ascendancy and military eminence of Miltiades that his brother generals, one and all, gave up their days of command to him, and cheerfully acted under his orders. Fearful, however, of creating any jealousy, and of so failing to obtain the cooperation of all parts of his small army, Miltiades waited till the day when the chief command would have come around to him in regular rotation before he led the troops against the enemy. The inaction of the Asiatic commanders during this interval appears strange at first sight, but Hippias was with them, and they and he were aware of their chance of a bloodless conquest through the machinations of his partisans among the Athenians. The nature of the ground also explains, in many points, the tactics of the opposite generals before the battle, as well as the operations of the troops during the engagement. The plain of Marathon, which is about 22 miles distant from Athens, lies along the bay of the same name on the northeastern coast of Attica. The plain is nearly in the form of a crescent, and about 6 miles in length. It is about 2 miles broad in the center, where the space between the mountains and the sea is greatest, but it narrows towards either extremity, the mountains coming close down to the water at the horns of the bay. There is a valley, trending inwards from the middle of the plain, and a ravine comes down to it, to the southward. Elsewhere, it is closely girt round on the land side by rugged limestone mountains, which are thickly studded with pines, olive trees, and cedars, and overgrown with the myrtle, arbutus, and other low odoriferous shrubs that everywhere perfume the Attic air. The level of the ground is now varied by the mound raised over those who fell in the battle, but it was an unbroken plain when the Persians encamped on it. There are marshes at each end, which are dry in spring and summer, and then offer no obstruction to the horsemen, but are commonly flooded with rain, and so rendered impracticable for cavalry in the autumn, the time of year at which the action took place. The Greeks, lying encamped on the mountains, could watch every movement of the Persians on the plain below, while they were enabled completely to mask their own. Miltiades also had, from his position, the power of giving battle whenever he pleased, or of delaying it at his discretion, unless Datis were to attempt the perilous operation of storming the heights. If we turn to the map of the Old World to test the comparative territorial resources of the two states whose armies were now about to come into conflict, the immense preponderance of the material power of the Persian king over that of the Athenian Republic is more striking than any similar contrast which history can supply. It has been truly remarked that, in estimating mere areas, Attica, containing on its whole surface only 700 square miles, shrinks into significance if compared with many a baronial fief of the Middle Ages, or many a colonial allotment of modern times. Its antagonist, the Persian Empire, comprised the whole of modern Asiatic and most of modern European Turkey, the modern kingdom of Persia, and the countries of modern Georgia, Armenia, Balkh and Punjab, Afghanistan, Baluchistan, Egypt, and Tripoli. Nor could a European, in the beginning of the 5th century before our era, look upon this huge accumulation of power beneath the scepter of a single Asiatic ruler with the indifference with which we now observe on the map the extensive dominions of modern Oriental sovereigns. For, as has been already remarked, before Marathon was fought, the prestige of success and of supposed superiority of race was on the side of the Asiatic against the European. Asia was the original seat of human societies, and long before any trace can be found of the inhabitants of the rest of the world having emerged from the rudest barbarianism, we can perceive that mighty and brilliant empires flourished in the Asiatic continent. They appear before us through the twilight of primeval history, dim and indistinct, but massive and majestic, like mountains in the early dawn. Instead, however, of the infinite variety and restless change which have characterized the institutions and fortunes of European states ever since the commencement of the civilization of our continent, a monotonous uniformity pervades the histories of nearly all Oriental empires, from the most ancient down to the most recent times. They are characterized by the rapidity of their early conquests, the immense extent of the dominions comprised in them, by the establishment of a satrap or pacha system of governing the provinces, by an invariable and speedy degeneracy in the princes of the royal house, the effeminate nurslings of the seraglio succeeding to the warrior sovereigns reared in the camp, and by the internal anarchy and insurrections which indicate and accelerate the decline and fall of these unwieldy and ill-organized fabrics of power. It is also a striking fact that the governments of all the great Asiatic empires have in all ages been absolute despotisms. And Hieron is right in connecting this with another great fact, which is important from its influence both on the political and the social life of the Asiatics. Among all the considerable nations of Inner Asia, the paternal government of every household was corrupted by polygamy. Where that custom exists, a good political constitution is impossible. Fathers being converted into domestic despots, and ready to pay the same abject obedience to their sovereign which they exact from their family and dependents in their domestic economy. We should bear in mind also the inseparable connection between the state religion and all legislation, which has always prevailed in the East, and the constant existence of a powerful sacerdotal body, exercising some check, though precarious and irregular, over the throne itself, grasping at all civil administration, claiming the supreme control of education, stereotyping the lines on which literature and science must move,